Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. On the podcast this time, we have lots of fun stuff. Yeah! We get a nerdy question from Aura, which I had a heck of a lot of fun answering. Delia from Wisconsin tells us about a protective ghost.
Did you say a bloody ghost?
Yes, I said ghost. We will continue with a walk in a ghostly park and read more of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
Okay.
Then we end it all with Tom warning us about bologna and mayonnaise sandwiches. Now, I think you know what I'm going to say next. It's time for this 5-Minute Mystery.
Another 5-Minute Mystery.
This 5-Minute Mystery is being brought to you by the English language. With proper use, English can be a powerful tool. But can it be used for murder? Probably not, but as we'll find out in today's story, it can be an implausible clue. And yes, I said implausible.
Far to the south, hidden in the mysterious low country of Cuba, a sugar plantation house, dimly lighted in the somber dusk. In the parlor of the house sits a small, thin woman.
Lester Lockwood is my brother, Inspector. His wife, Nydia, drove him to throw himself off the riverbank.
Suppose you tell me the whole story.
Well, 2 years ago, my brother and his wife left their professorships in the English department at Lynbrook College and came here to live and write. As time went by, Nydia became fascinated by the native drums. One night, she wandered alone in the jungle.
And never came back, yes, I remember.
And then the first of those mysterious notes appeared, written in blood on dried bark. I have been chosen, it said, for one of the living dead. Come to me, Lester, and share my eternity. It was signed, Nydia. Lester watched for her, certain somehow she'd come for him. And last night, we were standing on the jungle path.
Judith, the drums, they're getting louder. She will come, I know she will.
Oh, Lester, give up this plantation, it's evil.
It's too late. She's here. Oh. Listen, do you hear that?
What?
A movement, yonder beyond the trees. Look!
Lester, it is Nydia.
It's true. Oh. Judith, my wife's one of the living dead.
Lester, come back!
I've got to find her and save her from this voodoo magic.
He ran off in the darkness, and I went quickly back to the house to wait. And at last, Lester came back.
I couldn't find her. I looked everywhere.
Then you've got to come away from this place tonight.
Judith, look, here on the window ledge.
Oh, another of those terrible notes. What does it say?
You are a human. You cannot know the glory of eternal life. Come to the jungle, to the drums, and share my living death. Keep this between you and I.
Oh, she's trying to destroy you. Trying to, Lester.
I'm going to her, Judith.
No!
Lydia's waiting for me to come.
Lester, come back! Come back!
And this is the note your brother found last night on the window ledge, Miss Lockwood.
Eh? Yes. Others, I suppose he destroyed them.
I see. And you say your brother's wife was formerly an English instructor?
At Lynbrook. She met Lester there.
Your story, Miss Lockwood, is interesting, and I think I know the truth. But the chief at headquarters would rather hear it from you, so come along.
What was the clue that led Inspector James to arrest Judith Lockwood? In a moment, he'll tell us, but first...
Okay, so the inspector took Judith Lockwood to the pokey for the murder of her brother. I have to wonder why. After all, was there really a murder, or did the couple decide to become the living dead? I think that this one might surprise us, so what do you say we go find out?
And now, here's Inspector James.
Under questioning, Judith Lockwood broke down and confessed to the murder of her brother and his wife. She was a pretty mixed-up woman, but she had imagination. I knew Judith had written the note herself because no instructor of the English language is going to make 2 grammatical errors in 4 short sentences. You don't say human for human being. And nothing is ever between you and I. So, if you didn't know, let's keep it between you and me.
Wow, a poorly written note is the evidence. It's a good thing she broke down and told the truth, because I don't think grammar speaks to motive, opportunity, or even zombieism. Is that even a word? So many questions. This mystery was brought to you by the English language, and please be careful with your words, or at least how you write them. I have to say that we have an email question from Aura Stone from Chicago, Illinois. Aura writes, I wanted to say how much I love the podcast and I love the story, Anything You Can Do. What a classic. But it begs the question, how is this story so technically accurate and not copyrighted? There are too many things that are current tech that it's hard to believe that it's that old. Ron, what is the rest of the story? Aura Stone, Chicago. Aura, I love this question because for a moment I get to geek out. Anything You Can Do, the novel, was written in 1963 by Randall Garrett. However, there is an earlier printing by Garrett writing as Daryl T. Langert. This version appeared in the pulp mags of the time, and while close to the novel, it is not the same. Fast forward to the year 1978, when the current copyright laws were established. Prior to 1978, works had to be published or registered to receive copyright protection. It was the responsibility of the creators or those given the rights to establish the copyright. In 2009, the Gutenberg Project determined that these rights were not enforced and Anything You Can Do was released as certified public domain work. Which means we can not only read it, but if we want to, we can monetize it. How about that? Now to answer your second question. By the year 1963, when the book was written, Randall had a much better idea of what the future would hold and why the story has a more modern feel. However, having said that, you still have to marvel at just how right Mr. Garrett got things. Like in last week's story, he spoke about an internet of sorts that was dead on with what we have today. Amazing. Thank you for the question, Aura. I hope that I answered it for you. By the way, I love your name and pretty sure I've never heard it before. Later in the show, we will play chapters 17 and 18 of Anything You Can Do. And we are getting down to the wire. After this week, there are only 4 chapters left. Good stuff. Did you know that Ron's Amazing Stories is also an on-air radio show? We are a member of the family of podcasters and hosts at AMFM247.com. They combine the best of AM and FM radio into one channel. Now you won't have to switch between frequencies to get your favorite podcasts or hear the best music. AMFM 247 features hit talk shows touching on a variety of topics, providing something for everyone. It also brings you the best music FM radios have to offer. You'll enjoy music from the 1940s all the way up to today's top hits. Also, look for Ron's Amazing Stories every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Pacific. That's 11 p.m. Eastern. Our podcast kicks off a full 3-hour segment of old-time radio. So head to AMFM247.com for more information and stations in your area. Thank you, AM FM 247. And now, these are your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
We have one more story left over from the month of Spooky 2018. It comes from Delia Powell, who writes us from Brooks, Wisconsin. When I receive emails or messages from folks, I like to look at where these towns are on the map. One day I'm going to get a map of the world and start putting pins into it. When I went to research Brooks, I had some trouble finding it, and at first I thought it was a fake. But in the end, I did find it located in central Wisconsin. There's hardly any information on the place, and for good reason. Brooks, Wisconsin is located at the intersection of County Road ANG in the Northchester Township, close to the Upper Nehaw Creek State Fishery Area. Needless to say, Brooks is a small community of mostly full-time homes. Think about that for a minute. It has a church with a bar and grill inside and a railroad on the east side. This area is mostly farms, woods, and wetlands. How about that? Brooks has to be one of the more interesting locales that we've had on the show. Now, like so many of our listeners do, Delia sent a note before she sent her story. Ron, I want to thank you for the podcast and everything you do for us. I live in a remote area, and getting podcasts can be a problem. At certain times of the year, we may or may not have power, and even at the best of times, our cell phone coverage is spotty. I'm going to record my story on my iPhone in hopes that you can use it. Be looking for it soon. Delia. Well, I put that note aside, and 2 weeks later, I received this second note. Ron, I recorded my story, but it's too large to attach to an email, so I can't send it. Is there a way to send it via the post? Delia. To which I wrote back and said, that could be a problem and would cost a bit for the media. I suggest we get together via phone call and record the story that way. She agreed, and we set a date. The date came and went. Her cell phone coverage had gone out. We reset and tried again. However, this time the quality of the call was so poor that recording it just wasn't going to work. But I did hear the story and asked if I could write it for her and send it to her for approval. She agreed, and this is Delia's story. My story begins when I was a little girl growing up in Madison, Wisconsin. My family lived in a very old house that was built in the early 1900s. The house has quite a history. It was at one time a brothel, a care facility for polio victims, and later a funeral home. My parents bought it in the early 1980s, and as you might guess, growing up there was interesting. To say the house was haunted is an understatement. We just got used to strange things going on. There were bumps in the night, apparitions going up and down the stairs, and of course, the occasional scream were commonplace. I could tell you a story from almost every day in my childhood, but there is one that stands as my favorite. One of the owners of the house was a man by the name of Charles Barrows. Not much is known about the man other than he was a well-to-do businessman with a wife and 7 children. He truly loved his family and took care of them the best he could. The story goes that one morning while going to work, he stepped out into the street, was struck by a car, and killed. His family was, of course, devastated and didn't know what they were going to do without him. They need not have worried, because financially he left them in a very good position to where they could live the rest of their lives in comfort. However, that was not enough for Charles, and he wanted to do more. One of the ghosts that's said to reside in my old house is that of Charles Barrows. It appears that even after death, he continues to care for the house and its occupants. This is where my story begins. One night, my parents had gone out to a party and left us kids all alone at home. My older sister, Gwyneth, was left in charge. It was getting late, and she sent us each to our various bedrooms throughout the house, when all of a sudden there was a crash in the downstairs living room. It was followed by angry voices telling someone to keep quiet. Our house was being robbed. All of us kids gathered up together, and we were unsure what to do when we heard a scream come from the downstairs. Then one of the men threw open the door and ran out of the house. Soon to follow were the rest of his crew. One of the neighbors must have saw or heard something and had already called the police. The men ran right into the open arms of the gendarme. All of us kids sighed in relief and knew that we were now safe. The next morning, Father read us the newspaper. It carried the story of the men that attempted to rob us. It said that one of the men had been terrified by an apparition of a man threatening them with a cane. It might interest you to know that on the main stairway landing is a picture painted of Charles Barrows. In that picture, Charles is holding a very opulent walking cane. That is my favorite story from childhood, and there are many more. If you are interested and want to check it out, you can find this story listed in the archives of the Daily Cardinal, which is one of the newspapers in Madison. Delia Powell, Brooks, Wisconsin. Well, Delia, I for one vote for more stories. What a fantastic tale. Who doesn't love a ghost story with a happy ending? A couple of notes for this one. If you look at the show art this week, you will see for yourself the town of Brooks, Wisconsin. I just had to do that. Also, I decided to call this story the Brooks Robbery, and yes, I know it took place in Madison. Thank you, Delia, for the story, and thank you to everyone in Brooks, Wisconsin. This next story comes from Sandy Harmon from Parts Unknown. Not even a guess this time, because Sandy used an email that blocked my attempt to trace its origin. So we'll just say Sandy writes us from the unknown. Sandy writes, "Thank you for the podcast. I listen each week and marvel at the stuff you come up with. It's so entertaining. I want to share a story that happened to me this past summer. I was walking in a local park when I got this feeling that I was being followed. I turned around and there was no one there, but just to be on the safe side, I took a second look. I kept on walking, and coming from the other direction, I saw a man walking his dog. This made me feel a little better since now I really wasn't alone, but I still had that feeling I was being watched. As I walked by the man, he stopped me and asked if I had seen anyone in the area. I responded I hadn't, but asked him why he was asking. He told me that he had this strange sensation that he was being watched. I told him my story, and we both laughed about it. We continued to talk when another lady came up to us and said that she could not help but overhear us and that she, too, felt like she was being followed and watched. This was too strange. We all chatted a bit longer, thought that we must be crazy, laughed about that, and then went our separate ways. That night, I had a dream about walking in that very same park. I remember in my dream that I was looking around and a bum walking up to me and asking for some food. I told him that I was out walking and that I really didn't have anything for him this time. That was the dream. And the odd thing was is that it felt so very real. The next morning, I was listening to the radio, and one of the stories that they were reporting was that the night before that, a transient man had been found dead in that park. He had died of natural causes, and authorities were having trouble identifying him. Ron, that is my story, and I hope you enjoy it. It's true and probably doesn't mean anything, but I thought I should send it in. Sandy Harmon, from Parts Unknown. Well, thank you for your story, Sandy. That is a head-scratcher for sure. I have to say, I doubt it was a coincidence that all three of you felt the same way at the same time, but I guess it could happen. I would lean more towards what I think you were getting at. The man was left wondering a bit. I do hope he found his way to the light.
It's time for another chapter of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. Things have gotten dicey for the Knipe team. Bart Stanton has disappeared, and the Knipe has not only killed and eaten Colonel Mannheim, it seems that the Colonel allowed it. And now, Chapter 17 and 18 of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
"It is not your fault, Bart," said George Yoritomo softly. "You had a perfect right to go." Bart Stanton clenched his fists and turned suddenly to face the Japanese psychologist. "Sure, hell yes. We're not discussing my rights, George. We're discussing my criminal stupidity. I had the right to leave here any time I wanted to, sure. But I didn't have the right to exercise that right, if that makes any sense to you." "It makes sense," Yoritomo agreed, "but it is not the way to look at it. You could not have been with the Colonel every minute of every day. There was no way of knowing—" "Of course not," Stanton cut in angrily. "But I should have been there this time. He wanted me there, and I was gone. If I'd been there, he'd be alive at this moment." "Possibly," Yoritomo said. "And then again, possibly not. Sit down over there on your bed, my young friend, and listen to me. Sit. That's it. Take a deep breath. Hold it and relax. I want your ears functioning when I talk to you. That's better. Now, I do not know where you went. That is your business. All you—" "I went to Denver," Stanton said. "And you found—" "Nothing," Stanton said. "Absolutely nothing." "What were you looking for?" "I don't know. Something about my past. Something about myself. I don't know." "Ah, you went to look up your family. You were trying to fill the holes in your memory, eh?" "Yes." "And you did not succeed?" "No, no. There wasn't anything there that I didn't remember. In general, I mean. I found the files in the Bureau of Statistics. I know how my father died now, and how my mother died, and what happened to my brother. But all that didn't tell me anything. I'm still looking for something, and I don't know what it is. I was stupid to have gone. I suppose I should have asked you or Dr. Farnsworth or the Colonel." "But you thought we wouldn't answer," Yoritomo said. "I guess that's about it. I should have asked you." Yoritomo shook his head. "Not necessarily. It was actually better that you looked for yourself. Besides, we could not have given you any answer if you yourself do not know the question. We still can't." "I have a feeling," Stanton said, "that you know the question as well as the answer." "Perhaps, perhaps not. But there are some things that every man must find out for himself. You were right to do as you did. If you had asked Colonel Mannheim for permission, he would have let you go. He would not have asked you to go to Government City with him. That's the whole damn trouble," Stanton snapped. "I'm the star boarder around here, the indispensable man. So I'm babied and I'm coddled. And when I goof off, I'm patted on the back." "And just how did you goof off?" Yoritomo asked. I should have been there, ready to go with the colonel. Very well. Suppose you had gone. Do you think you could have saved his life? He could have saved his own life if he wanted to. Instead, he specifically ordered the guard not to shoot under any circumstances. If you had been there, the results would have been the same. He would have forbidden you to do anything at all. The time is not yet ripe for you to face the knife. You would not have been able to protect him without disobeying his orders. I might have done just that, said Stanton. Yoritomo was suddenly angry. Then it is better that you were in Denver, young fool. Colonel Walther Mannheim believed that no single human life is worth the loss of the knowledge in that alien's mind. He proved that by sacrificing his own life when that became necessary. I'd like to think that I would have done the same thing myself. I am certain Dr. Farnsworth would. We would rather all be dead than allow that fund of data to be lost to the rest of humanity. But who will carry on with him dead? Stanton asked. He was the one who coordinated everything. You and Farnsworth aren't cut out for that sort of thing. Nor am I. No, Yoritomo said, but that has already been taken care of. Mannheim had a replacement ready. A message is being sent out in Mannheim's name, since we are keeping the colonel's death secret for the time being. You are the only indispensable man, Stanton. The rest of us can easily be replaced. The lives of dozens of human beings have been sacrificed. 5 years of your own life have been sacrificed to put you in the right place at the right time. And the job you are to do does not and never has included acting as bodyguard for Colonel Mannheim or anyone else. Understand? Stanton nodded slowly. I understand, George. I understand. Chapter 18. The detective pushed his way out of the crowded courtroom before the rest of the crowd started to move. The members of the jury were still filing in, and he knew that no one else would leave the room until the verdict was in. He didn't care. He knew what the verdict ought to be. He knew also that juries had occasionally been swayed by histrionics on the part of the defense counsel, and had been persuaded to free guilty men. He knew, too, that prosecutors had railroaded innocent men. But such things as that didn't happen often in the Belt. A man doesn't live too long in the Belt unless he's capable of recognizing truth when he sees it. But even if the wrong verdict had been brought in, there would have been nothing he could do about it now. He had done his part. He had done everything he could. He had brought them in. He had testified. All the rest of it was up to the jury and the court, those two enigmatic halves of justice and judgment. The point was that this was the perfect time to leave the courtroom. When he reached his office, he could if he wanted, and he thought ruefully he probably would want to, in spite of his pretended indifference, call up to find out what the verdict had been. But during these few moments, all eyes were on the jury box. No one was watching who left quietly by the side door of the big courtroom. He moved silently and with assurance in the fractional G field of the planetoid. One of the uniformed guards looked at him and smiled, throwing him an informal salute. The detective returned both. "If any of those news reporters ask which way I went," he said amiably, "tell 'em I went that-a-way." He gestured over his shoulder with a thumb. "I ain't even seen you, Mr. Martin," said the guard. The detective waved his thanks and kept going. It wasn't that he disliked newsmen. Most of them were fairly intelligent, pleasant people. But he didn't want to be asked any questions right now. He had given them interviews aplenty during the trial, and they could use those now that the end of the trial had lifted the news ban. They had plenty of quotations from Stan Martin without asking him what he thought of the verdict itself. 10 minutes later, he was in his own office in the Lloyd's area. Helen, his secretary, was just cutting off the phone as he walked into the outer office. She flashed him a big smile. "They just gave the verdict, Mr. Martin. Guilty all the way down the line. Conspiracy, extortion, kidnapping, and all the others. the only not guilty verdict was a minor one. They decided that Hedgepeth wasn't involved in the actual kidnapping itself, and therefore wasn't guilty of the physical assault of the guard. "They're probably right," the detective said, "but, as you said, it's a minor point. It doesn't much matter whether he was physically present at the time the boy was taken or not. He was certainly in on the plot." He paused, frowning. "That's over and done with, except for a possible appeal, and it's unlikely that that would involve us anyway. Get Mr. Pelham on the phone, will you? I'll take it in my office." "The Morton case?" she asked. "Yeah, there's something fishy about the wreck of the spaceship Morton, and I want Pelham to let me work on it." He went on into his office and had barely sat down when the phone hummed. "Yes?" he said, depressing the switch. "Mr. Ben Heim would like to speak to you, sir," Helen said formally.
"Oh?"
In order to have gotten here so quickly, Ben Heim, too, must have left before the verdict was delivered. He was hardly more than a minute behind the detective. And that was unusual in a man who was waiting at the trial of the kidnappers of his own son. Still, Moshe Ben Heim was an unusual man. "Tell him to come right on in," the detective said. "Oh, and Helen, hold off on that Pelham call for a little while." He didn't want to be talking business while Ben Heim was in the office.
"Yes, sir," she said.
A few seconds later, the door opened and Moshe Ben Heim came in. He was not a big man, but he was broad of shoulder and broad of girth, built like a wrestler. He had a heavy, graying beard and wore it with a patriarchal air. He was breathing rather heavily as he came through the door, and he stopped suddenly to pull a handkerchief from his pocket. He began coughing, harsh, racking, painful coughs that shook his heavy frame.
"Sorry," he said after a moment. "Damn lungs. Shouldn't try to move so fast."
He wiped his lips and put the handkerchief away. The detective didn't say anything. He knew that Moshe Ben Heim had injured his lungs 18 years before. An accident in space had ruptured his spacesuit, and the explosive decompression that had resulted had almost killed him. He had saved his own life by holding the torn spot with one hand and turning up the air tank valve full blast with the other. The rough patch job had held long enough for him to get back inside his ship, but his lungs had never been the same, and his eyes were eternally bloodshot from the ruptured and distended capillaries.
"I noticed you slipped out of the courtroom," he went on. "I hope you don't mind my following you."
"Of course not, Mr. Ben Heim," the detective said. "Sit down." Ben Heim sat in the chair across the desk from the detective.
"I didn't wait for the verdict," he said. "I knew the conviction was certain after you testified."
"Thanks. My secretary got the news just before you came in. Guilty straight across the board. But your son's testimony was a lot more telling than mine."
"Guilty," Ben Heim repeated with satisfaction. "Naturally. What else? I admit my son's testimony was good," he continued. "Little Schmuller told his story like a little man up there in the witness box. Never looked scared, never got mixed up. But Schmuller's testimony was your testimony too, Mr. Martin. If it hadn't been for you, he wouldn't be here to testify, for which I'm grateful to God."
Then he leaned back and spread his hands apart in a gesture of dismissal.
"But that's all over and done with," he said. "I came about a different matter."
Again he paused, as if picking his words carefully.
"Do you know a man named Barnabas Nguma?"
"Nguma? Yes, I met him once. Why?"
"He was in the courtroom today. He came to see me just before court convened."
"Oh?" the detective said noncommittally.
"Yes. He claims to represent an organization on Earth which has been trying to hire you for a job there. Is that right?"
"That's right," the detective said warily. "What did he want with you?"
"Now, that's a funny thing," Ben Heim said. "It seems that he's under the impression that you turned down his job to take on this kidnapping. Is that right?"
"Not exactly," the detective said tightly. "I was working on your son's case before he and a couple of other men came out here to talk to me. But they'd written to me long before that."
He wondered what Ben Heim was getting at. He didn't know any explanations to the industrialist, but, on the other hand, he couldn't be impolite to him.
"I see," Ben Heim said, nodding his head slowly. "Like most Earthies, Mr. Nguma is suffering under a misapprehension. He seems to think that I have some sort of hold over you, that I was the one who made you turn down his job so that you'd take my case."
"Oh? Was he angry because you'd put your own selfish interests ahead of his unselfish ones?" the detective asked with a trace of hard sarcasm in his voice.
"Oh, no," said Ben Heim. "Oh, no, not at all. He said he understood perfectly. But he wondered if, now that my boy had been returned safely, I might not put a little pressure on you to get you to take his case."
"And what did you say?"
Moshe Ben Heim scowled. "I told him exactly where he could head in. I told him that I had no power over you whatever, that I hadn't hired you at all, that I didn't even know that you were working on the case until after you rescued Shmuel. I told him that even if I held the power of life and death over you, I would never lift so much as a finger against you. I told him that it was just the other way around, in fact. I told him that you have such a power over me because of what you did for Shmuel that it is I who will jump through your hoop if ordered, not the other way around. I was quite angry."
Ben Heim relaxed a little before going on.
"Actually, I'm sorry I blew up. He's a well-meaning man, I think."
"No doubt," the detective said. "Did he tell you what the job was?"
"With most heart-rending particulars," said Ben Heim. "I was told all about how this Knipe has been killing and eating people, as if I didn't know already. But it wasn't until I heard him talk that I realized how scared people are back there on Earth. You know, Martin, we're insulated out here. We don't feel that terror, even when we read about it or see the reports on the newscasts. If everybody on Earth is as scared as that Mr. Nguma is, it's a wonder they haven't all panicked and taken to running around in circles."
"As a matter of fact, Mr. Ben Heim," the detective said levelly, "they have begun to do just that. Mr. Nguma and his friends have been after me for a long time to take their job. They have pulled every trick they can think of, including this last one with you, to get me to go back to Earth and find that monster. I have refused them so often and so firmly that they are convinced I'm afraid to tackle the Knipe. They are convinced that I know I'll fail, and yet they keep after me. If that isn't running around in circles, it'll do until a better example comes along."
"They're out of their minds," Ben Heim said flatly. "Of course, no man in his right mind would try to face down that thing. It would be as silly as trying to outrun a bullet or do arithmetic faster than a computer. That's common sense. That's showing a healthy respect for the Knipe, not fear. At least, not fear in the way that those men are afraid."
Suddenly, the detective knew why the industrialist had come. He knew that Moshe Ben Heim wanted to reassure Stanley Martin, to tell him that he was doing the sensible thing in turning down so dangerous an assignment. He could almost have predicted word for word what Ben Heim was going to say next.
"Nguma may be here at any minute," said the industrialist. "He told me that he was going to come as soon as the trial was over. What are you going to tell him this time? I know it's none of my business, but I'm asking just the same."
"I'm going to tell him no," the detective said. "I will not return to Earth for any reason whatever."
"Good," said Ben Heim. "Good. That's the smart thing to do. And don't let him buffalo you. We know you out here in the Belt, Martin. I've been out here for 30 years, and I know what kind of guts it takes to do the things you've done. Those men don't understand space. Nobody understands space until he's lived in it and worked in it, and had cold death only a fraction of an inch away from his skin for hours and days at a time. No matter what those Earthies say, we know you've got more guts than anybody else in the Belt, to say nothing of those stay-at-homes on Earth."
"Thank you. I appreciate that," the detective said. But they were only words. He knew that Ben Heim meant exactly what he said, or thought he meant it,
but he also knew that Benheim and others would always wonder why he had turned the job down.
God, he thought, I wish I knew.
The thought was only momentary. Then, as it had done so many times before, his mind veered away from the dangerous subject. Moshe Benheim stood up.
Well, that's all I had to say, Mr. Martin. I just wanted to warn you that that man might be coming around and to tell you how I felt. Remember what I said about jumping through a hoop. Any time you need me, for anything at all, you just say so. Understand?
I understand, the detective said, forcing a smile. He rose and shook the industrialist's outstretched hand. And thanks again, he added. After Benheim had gone, the detective sat thinking, toying with a pencil on his desk. Moshe Benheim, like so many others in the Belt, had come out with nothing but his brain and his two hands and the equipment necessary to keep him alive. In 30 years, he had parlayed that into one of the biggest fortunes in the solar system. It was men like that whose respect he valued, and on the surface he apparently had that respect. But refusing the knipe job would dull the bright sheen of that respect, and he knew it. Benheim had talked about how foolish it would be to try to beat the knipe in a face-to-face encounter, but he hadn't meant it. He knew perfectly well that all Stanley Martin would be expected to do would be to find out where the knipe's hideout was. Once that had been accomplished, men and machines, most especially machines, could wipe the monster from the face of the earth. One well-placed bomb would do it, if the authorities only knew where to place that bomb. If only. Again his mind veered away, refusing to consider the knipe too carefully or too closely. The intercom on his desk hummed, and he pressed the switch. Yes, Helen?
That Mr. Ngumu was here while Mr. Benheim was with you, Mr. Martin. I followed your instructions and told him that you would not see him.
Fine. Thanks, Helen.
Also, there's a radiogram for you from Earth.
If it's from one of Nguma's colleagues, the detective said, I don't want to see it. File it in the cylindrical file, under W.
I don't think it is, the secretary said doubtfully. I can't make any sense out of it. I'd better bring it in.
Okay, and then put that call through to Pelham. I want to get going on that Morton spaceship wrecking. I'm getting itchy for action.
She brought in the radiogram and put it on his desk before calling Pelham. She had already read it, of course. It was her job to read such things.
The detective picked up the sheet of paper and read it.
The operation is about to begin. I need the other half of my forceps. Come home and join the big parade. Manheim.
It took a second for the words to really impress themselves on his mind. He read them over again. And then the veil began to drop from the closed-off part of his mind. Memories began to swarm back into his mind, memories that had been walled off and kept away from his conscious mind by the hypnotic suggestion implanted so long ago. Oddly, it did not surprise or shock him. He was an expert at hypnosis, especially self-hypnosis. He recognized the message for exactly what it was, a series of code phrases designed to break the blockage that had been placed in his mind. His only reaction was to laugh aloud.
"By God," he said, "it worked! It actually worked! Nearly 6 years and I never suspected once!"
The phone hummed. He switched it on.
"Mr. Pelham is on the phone, Mr. Martin," Helen said.
He watched as the florid, smiling face of Pelham, his superior, appeared on the screen.
"What can I do for you, Martin?" he asked.
"I have a favor to ask, Mr. Pelham."
"Anything within reason," Pelham said. "After this Benheim affair, you're in good standing around here," he chuckled.
"I want a leave of absence," the detective said. Pelham looked a little surprised.
"Well, I guess you deserve it. You need a rest, I imagine."
"No," the detective said. "No, it isn't that. I'm going after bigger game is all."
"What's that?"
"I'm going to Earth to find the knipe."
That's all for now. Next week, Chapter 19 of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
Hot dog, Armor hot dog. What kinds of kids eat Armor hot dog?
Fat kids, skinny kids, kids who climb on rocks. Tough kids, busy kids.
Even kids with chicken pox love hot dog.
Armor hot dog.
Kids love to fight.
Picking it up on the old banjo, put on the mustard and away we go.
But when kids fight, dogs they yell.
Hooray for hot dogs.
Armor hot dogs.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by Amazing People.
This time on As Read By, we continue growing up with Tom Williams. Tom lives in Berlin, Germany, was raised in Alabama, and has sent in these tales from his youth. In this edition, Tom warns us about bologna and mayonnaise in a story he calls
Growing Up, Grandma's House. As I mentioned before, Grandma's house was the biggest house in Whistler. Now, my following description of this house is intended not to brag or put on airs, as they used to say. It had wide steps leading up to the middle of the front porch. The porch ran the length of the front of the house with a wooden swing on the right side. The swing was held up with small chains and was at the very, very end of the porch, which was fun for the cousins and myself. The front door was in the middle of the house and was never locked, only the screen door was locked to keep the babies from going out and getting into the street. That was the only reason. Entering the front door, you found yourself facing a long hallways with those 10-foot ceilings that helped keep the place cool. And on the left side, there was an old wooden wardrobe. No such thing as walk-in closets those days. From that long hallway, doors left and right led into various rooms. I only remember there being two rooms on the right and two rooms on the left, but many tell me there were three on each side. Not important, though. At the far end of the hallway and to the right, the door led into the sparse kitchen. A dining table, sink, and icebox. Maybe an ironing board when it was put out. No, I said icebox, not refrigerator. And there you would have an iceman bring a block of ice in from the horse-drawn wagon and place it in the top of the icebox. My job when I was there was to empty the pan of melted water from underneath before it ran over, which was seldom. My idea was to avoid having to stop my important playing outside. Didn't go across very well with my grandmother. I simply suggested that I drill a hole in the floor for drainage and save all the work. And let them snakes in my house, she said. Ain't no way. From the kitchen there was a door that led out to the small back porch. Our fun days were when all cousins came to visit Grandma, and that was mostly on weekends. We would cram as many cousins into the swing as possible, and Cousin Fearless Fred would mount the back of the swing with the toes in between the wooden slats and hold on to the back, and we would swing out over the porch and back as high as we could, never quite reaching the ceiling, which was our main goal. By the squeals of the kids, you knew how much fun we were having. That is, until an adult would put a stop to it. You youngins are going to kill yourself. That swing can't hold all of you. I remember once the swing broke. As my corpulent aunt and a friend, I believe it was a date at the time, sat in it. She never went out with him again. I guess that was a sign from somewhere, at least to her. The yard in the front consisted of various plants and bushes. The one flower bush was, as my grandmother called it, 5 o'clocks. And as she showed me the first time, at exactly 5 o'clock, the flowers would close up their blooms for the night. Fascinating. There was also the elephant bush, too. The leaves were, with no exaggeration, large as elephant ears. Now, to relieve you of boredom and make the final story, I'll tell you of the day we almost died. Me and my cousins were playing in the front yard near those bushes. My cousin Barb asked us, "Do you want a bologna and mayonnaise sandwich? I'll make it for you." Well, her brother and I couldn't turn that down. My cousin Kerm and I went in for a while, and soon came the white bread, as they call it in the South, light bread sandwiches, presented on a plate. We bit into the sandwich with gusto, which only took a second for us to spit it out again. The inside of our mouths, tongue, and small portions of our throat went number than in a dentist's office. We were fortunate that we weren't poisoned that day. We didn't swallow any of it, because she had cut round sections out of one of those elephant ears leaves and used it as bologna. The plant is very poisonous, we discovered later. So, here's to the real bologna and mayonnaise days. Oh, and don't forget that tall glass of cold milk. Sincerely, Tom.
I love Tom's stories because they always remind me of something from my past. My mother loves rhubarb pie, and my dad could grow anything. So he got some rhubarb cuttings and started growing them in the backyard. This was great because each year my mom would bake pies from these plants. One year, my mom sent my older sister out to harvest for a pie. After a while, she came back with the bounty and proudly announced that while the stalks taste great, the leaves are so much better to eat, and why don't we use them? Well, my mother turned white, grabbed her daughter, and off to the emergency room they went. Why? Rhubarb leaves can't be eaten. They're poisonous, but the stalks are pretty much like sugarcane. My sister survived that, and to this day, I cannot remember her eating rhubarb anything. Thank you, Tom, for your story and everything you do for the podcast. Oh, and Tom, get over your cold real soon. You hear? This is the end of the podcast, cue the sad music. This time I want to thank Aura Stone, Delia Powell, Sandy Harmon, Mark Nelson, and Tom Williams for their contributions. Next up on the podcast, more stories are coming. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you'll find everything you need. We are on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and just about any other service you can think of. Please leave us reviews and feedback about the show. It really helps us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.